From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Rochester's 19th Ward, where a single mother was struggling to find support for her daughter with autism. Clara Washington works full-time and cares for her 7-year-old daughter, Jayla. When Jayla was 4, Washington started noticing that Jayla was developing differently from her son. It took her a year to secure an evaluation for autism. Before Jayla was diagnosed, Washington said she didn't really understand what autism was. She told the Democrat and Chronicle that finding therapies for Jayla had been a fight. That changed with the help of Autism Up, a local nonprofit that connected Washington to resources and support services for both her daughter and herself. Washington's struggle is not unique. While Rochester is known throughout the country for excellence in autism diagnosis and treatment, there are disparities in how that care is accessed by people in different socioeconomic groups and in the suburbs versus the city. A National Autism Research Network described Rochester as a city where, quote, race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status have been associated with a delay in the diagnosis of ASD and access to services, end quote. The story is similar in cities across the country. Research shows African American and Hispanic children are less likely to receive an ASD diagnosis and intervention services. And so now a team of local organizations are working with the Golisano Autism Center to try to close that gap in Rochester. Their accelerated efforts come in light of the tragedy involving Trevion Rowe, the Rochester City School District student whose body was found in the Genesee River this past March. His family said he had autism. And we're going to discuss the center's new services this hour. We'll talk about why disparities in autism diagnosis and treatment exist. I'd like to welcome our guests. Mary Boatfield is board president for the Golisano Autism Center. Mary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Rachel Rosner is director of education and support for Autism Up. Welcome to you.
Thanks.
I'm Melissa Parrish, family navigator for the Golisano Autism Center and Autism Up employee. Melissa, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Susanna Iderola is a pediatric psychologist at Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong. And Dr. Iderola, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I'll start with Mary on this because you go back to the Trevion Rowe story. No one is going to say that there was an urgency in this community, but sometimes a tragedy brings things into light and maybe speeds up the process. And I wonder if that really is actually what's happening here in light of that.
I would agree. The Golisano Autism Center has been in development for about 2.5 years now. And when the tragedy did happen, we had already been working collaboratively with a number of different autism providers in our community to promote awareness and certainly connect individuals with service. And in light of that, in light of us not putting the shovel in the ground yet until October, we have developed two new initiatives. The Golisano Autism Center Helpline, which was launched on July 1st, and the Golisano Autism Center Family Navigator.
What kind of community, what was it like in the community watching the story unfold with Trevion Rowe and just how difficult that was?
Well, I think it was very tragic for anyone, for a parent, for a provider, knowing that these services do exist in our community, but collaboratively, the community needs to work together to make sure they're known, they're accessible, and that we are helping these families and individuals connect to these services that already exist. And obviously, there is a lack of awareness. There are 10,000 individuals in our community with autism, and we, as providers, need to do a better job of promoting those services and connecting families and individuals to those services.
Melissa, how did you feel watching that story unfold, and did you feel any additional sense of urgency from it?
As a parent of a child with autism, my heart broke. I think many of us all watched and thought there, but by the grace, that could have been any one of us. We have children who may wander off, may have instances of where there may have been signs earlier on that he was agitated or upset in some way, and the lack of responsiveness to that is one of the things that's critical in terms of preventing that type of tragedy.
I'm just reading Tom Golisano's recent op-ed published in the DNC, writing that autism doesn't discriminate, and many families in different settings do find it difficult to access resources, that this community has to grapple with that. And Dr. Iderola, how significant is that disparity in treatment and in just diagnosis and support service?
So nationally, there's a lot of data to suggest that there are very real disparities in terms of race, ethnicity, income, language of origin when it comes to all aspects along the autism spectrum. So getting referred for an evaluation, getting the diagnosis, getting access to services, what kind of quality of services you have access to. We're really lucky in the Rochester community that we're making great strides in that area. We have a fellow at the Developmental Behavioral Pediatrics who recently did a study, Dr. Jennifer Herrera, and showed that when you compared Latino children in our community with non-Latino white children in our community, that there are no differences in referral to diagnosis or first diagnosis. So we are making strides in that area for sure, but we recognize that these are very real disparities, and that when it comes that disparities at treatment is different from having equity at diagnosis.
Right.
You want to add to that, Rachel?
I absolutely agree. I think that not only does the research back that up with the data, but that's something that we know as parents on the ground, and that we know at Autism Up. That's the reason why Autism Up exists, to try to reach families in our community in a different way, to empower parents with information and education in a non-threatening way, to try to break down some of those barriers so that families can access diagnosis, therapies, services, and treatments for their kids.
One of the things that's extremely important to understand is that for autism, advocacy by parents for their children early on is an extremely important part of the process after a child is diagnosed, to advocate for them to receive the right services, for the parents to understand what this diagnosis means and how their child learns. In a system that may have a situations where parents of color, African-American parents, already don't have a positive relationship with the public school system. If that is present, then the likelihood that they're going to be able to advocate effectively in school for their child to receive the right placement in the right classroom, for the parent to understand, and the teacher and this other students to understand how that child is best to be integrated into the classroom. If there's already tension, and if there are already issues going on in the school where it isn't an open door, and parents don't feel trusted and they don't feel that they have a voice, then it's less likely that they're going to be able to access those services regarding autism within the school. So it's a complex issue.
Tell me more about your role, Melissa, that you're going to have here.
So as a family navigator, my role will be to work directly in the community. I'm going to be based in Boys and Girls Center right on Genesee Street. So I like that I'm grassroots. I'm right there in the community. Parents will be able to come into the center, get information about diagnosis. If they, let's say they just suspect something's going on with their child and they want to begin the process for diagnosis. So they would come to me, I would talk with them and connect them to programs at Golisano Children's Hospital, URMC, to help them begin to get connected in that process. Let's say they already have a diagnosis, but they would love for their child to participate in a daycare center, a program that is appropriate for their child's needs. But again, they don't know where those programs are. I would help them identify, you know, how to get into those programs, as well as get connected to other families that they can talk to. One of the things that Rachel and I talk about a lot in our involvement with Autism Up is that parents know a lot. They're on the front line. They know exactly what, you know, they has worked well for their kids. We have children, Rachel and I have children that are in 19, 20 right now. So we were where they were when they were 3 or 4 or 6. So talking to other parents who've been at those different stages is also very key.
Your son's how old now?
My son is 18. He'll be 19, yes.
Because, you know, in preparing for the program, for example, producer Megan Mack, you know, going through a lot of articles, you've been talking about your story for a number of years now.
I have.
You've been very public
here.
About it.
And, yes, I have.
And so mind if I just ask you a little bit about this? Because I think when people are hearing Melissa's story, the work you're going to do as a navigator is so important. But you've lived this with your family.
I did.
So let's go back to the diagnosis came. You moved from New York City to Rochester?
I moved from New York City to Rochester in 2005. My son was 6 at the time. So he was officially diagnosed in New York City. So when I arrived here, I already had the diagnosis. But I was immediately introduced to, you should go to Kirsch
And I said, okay, what's that? You know, I wasn't new to autism, but I was new to the Rochester area. And I was an advocate. So I had a binder full of all of his evaluations and everything that had happened for him up until that point. But initially when I arrived, he was placed in a RCSD school. It was a temporary placement, but a large part of what helped was that I knew what to ask for. I knew what he needed. I knew what kind of program he was in before he arrived in Rochester. I was able to talk about that program and talk about what the structure was and what was important for him. Now, my advocacy for him, I'm sure, sped up his placement in another RCSD school, which was the time was 28 school, and it was developing as an autism program. But I also had, you know, a very good psychologist in the RCSD system that identified and saw right away what kinds of services he needed. But while I was doing that for my son, I saw a lot of other students in this school at the time who may have been similar in terms of what their needs were that didn't necessarily have the information or access to some of the things that ultimately my son did over time. But it took a lot of, you know, talking to people and getting information and along the way, you know, learning and advocating for him.
Reading a 2014 Democrat and Chronicle article about this, you told the Democrat and Chronicle that there was a time where you could really only survive if you lived in poverty because of your son's disability. It made you unable to find a full-time job with the flexibility to meet the needs, and you couldn't find part-time income that met your family's needs. Give me a sense for what those decisions were like, what that was like.
When I moved to Rochester, you know, I was a person who had been a professional. I had a master's degree. I had a full career. But I had a six-year-old who could not go to a traditional daycare after school, though he was school-aged and, you know, would have been considered first grade, second grade, you know, would have typically been able to go to an after-school program. Well, he couldn't do that. And at the time, there were no after-school programs that could accommodate him. So as a result, I had to work Monday through Friday, 9 until 3. It couldn't be till 4. It couldn't be till 5. It had to be until 3 so that I can get him off that bus and give him the support he needed after school because of his needs. And what we've worked on over the years as parents and what Autism Up has been doing and several other organizations is recognizing that our children and our families that have autism need more support than just during the school day. That after school, these, you know, kids are going to need the support and that it will affect the family. I was an example of, you know, I love my son. So I put aside and we struggled and it definitely hurt us financially, but I love him. And I was going to do whatever I needed to do for him in order for him to get the services that he needed.
I mean, families with children who don't have autism are already trying to make daycare decisions on the cost of daycare. So correct. If I work full time, how much can I make versus what does daycare cost? Then you think about autism support and services.
Right.
You could have worked full time and that wouldn't even have covered the cost for the child care.
Not at all. Not at all. So that is a struggle that many parents are faced with. And I'm a single mom, so it wasn't as if I had the option of, you know, having a partner who could work a full-time job while I managed the things, the needs of the child. That just wasn't an option.
It is a complex issue tied to, it goes way beyond autism. I mean, what we're talking here is socioeconomics and the way poverty is structured socioeconomically.
Correct.
Along racial lines in some ways in this country. And I just want to ask Dr. Adirola, as you hear this, as we think about the families who are living on the poverty line, in poverty, trying to make decisions to the extent that they even understand a diagnosis or even have a diagnosis, but they still feel like you may be trapped. Mm-hmm. Where do we start to do about that tangibly?
I think we have to think about how do we get information disseminated equally to everyone within
yes.
our community, first and foremost. And this goes back to kind of systemic issues that are racially based and
yes.
economically based within our country. And so thinking about developing relationships that are authentic, to go back to your point, Melissa, with families, which is what gets families engaged in treatment and services, we have to think about really understanding all aspects of families, including those social determinants of health that might be affecting whether right. they do or do not engage in our systems. So relationship building is hugely important, and we as providers love building relationships with our families. But sometimes there's more trust in another parent than there is in a provider.
Yes.
And so to that end, I'm also again agreeing with you, Melissa. This is one of the reasons that we at the Levine Autism Clinic also have 4 family navigators on staff who are, including one that we share with Autism Up, and who are also parents of children with disabilities and who really get it. They can really form an emotional connection with parents yes. and provide more trusted information. And we're there with the backup, with the medical information, with feeding and the resources. But if you don't have the trust, then you're not going to engage.
Well, I want to listen to a comment, if we could, from a few months ago. When that story of Trevion Rowe hit this community hard, we had, as a guest on the program, Melanie Funches, who's Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester, and also newly appointed as a member of the Rochester School Board. And she was emotional about this, and she did not spare any of the details on how she views this problem, particularly in Rochester, and how it can have these disparities. Let's listen to what Melanie had to say.
If all things were being equal and he was white, the chances of him being able to walk off of the School 12 campus unseen would have been less. The chances of him being able to walk along the expressway to the Freddie Sue Bridge without somebody stopping would have been less. The chances of him being able to go to the bridge, look at the bridge, be on the other side of the bridge, and no one stopping for care and concern would have been less. And we, whether we want to talk about it or not, whether we want to own that or not as a community, is up to us. But that does not make it any less a fact, because we know that the literature states there is a study that talks about how young Black boys are seen as larger, older, and more dangerous. There are studies that talk about how young Black boys, there's tons of studies about the way that we as a society view young Black males. When we're not viewing them as a threat, we can view them as they can be rendered invisible. So my thing is that what I'm saying is backed up by the literature. And what I'm saying is that what I want us to not get lost in here is when people first wanted to look for him, it wasn't until we found out that he was a child with autism. It was the intersection of autism that made him visible and had hundreds of people looking. And I'm thankful for the people who looked.
What do you think, Melissa?
I'm really struck by the things that Melanie's saying. I feel it. My son was a wanderer. He was one of those kids that she's talking about, that 6 foot tall, and if you didn't know that he had autism, he would just be a tall, young Black male. And I remember when he was about 14, we lived in that Brooks Landing area near the Genesee River, and he wandered off a few times. And one time we were over near Highland. We were in the South Wedge. And this was a time, it's not uncommon that for some people on the autism spectrum that this is an issue, this wandering, this elopement issue. And so we had our protocols and our things in place. But I remember calling the police, and they found him and they brought him back. But they brought my baby back in the back of the police car with handcuffs on him. And that, it broke my heart. And so I immediately said to them, please take those off. Take those off. He's not a threat. And they said, oh, ma'am, we didn't know, and we didn't want him to hurt himself. And I had other instances with the police that did not turn out that way. They were very, very positive. But as a Black woman who has Black sons and has a child with autism, every time he wanders off every time there's an issue, I have to hope that they will see him as not a threat. And they will see him as an innocent child who needs help. But that's an issue. That is an issue I think about all the time.
I'm going to ask the rest of the panel, and I'll start with Dr. Adirola. Can you dispute anything you heard from Melanie in that clip there? I mean, I think she's making some powerful points. You agree?
Yes, I do agree. And I agree with what she said about that this isn't a comment on autism spectrum disorder. It's not even a comment on Rochester itself. It's a comment on our broader society and how we view different dimensions of diversity, especially race, especially in young men of color.
Rachel?
This is exactly the reason why I work so hard every day training and forging relationships with law enforcement in our community. I have been integrally involved in training every new recruit that comes through the training center out on Scottsville Road, working with the Sheriff's Department, working with RPD, and lots of suburban police departments, exactly about this. We show videos about different things that have happened in the past, talk about how behaviors can be misconstrued, and how to really get to the bottom of what's going on while still making sure that those officers are following their protocols in a way that's respectful for everyone and results in everybody going safely back home.
Mary?
We want every individual with autism to be visible, but be visible because they're unique and they're extraordinary, and every person is an individual. And that's why when we talk about the spectrum, each and every individual on the autism spectrum is an individual person. And I think, again, we come back to awareness in our community about autism, about individuals, about their needs, about the gaps in services that the Galisano Autism Center is intending to close those gaps 18 or 19 years later than probably we should in our community. But that is certainly our mission at this time.
We're going to take a phone call in a moment. We'll go to Bonnie in Rochester in just a moment. But let me just add a little bit more detail here that I think is really important. Producer Megan Mack points us to NPR coverage that bolsters what we're hearing from Melissa, from Melanie Funchess in the clip. So when Melanie talks about studies, listen to these here. Families and doctors alike can mistake autism spectrum disorder for simple bad behavior, especially in boys, as research has found. A study at McGill University in Montreal found that doctors were more hesitant to diagnose autism spectrum disorder in minority families. A study by a team at the Center for Autism and Developmental Disabilities Research and Epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania found that African-American children were 5.1 times more likely to be misdiagnosed with just conduct disorders before being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder.
I concur. I can give a personal example. When my son was 6 years old, he was going through a period in his autism where he was very physically active, and my son isn't very verbal. So one of the things that can happen is that as he's expressing himself, he's a very physical kid. Well, I remember being at RCSD and sitting at a meeting, and I remember walking in, and there must have been about 12 people around this table just for my little six-year-old. And one of the things they were talking about was his one-to-one aid and requesting that he have a male, because they thought that as he was getting larger and that, the need was there. But I remember the framing of what was being discussed. I had to clarify and say, wait a minute. My son isn't being violent. Because there was this coded language that was, we have to get a male because some of the women that have worked with him, they're concerned that they're going to be hurt and that he's going to hurt them. And I said, well, wait a minute. Are we talking about he's not intentionally trying to harm anyone? In his autism and in the behavior that happens, we may want a male because they're better equipped to be able to deal with the issues that are occurring. But I had to reframe it because I remember I was really uncomfortable sitting around a table and having this characterization of my son as if he was intentionally trying to harm someone. And as an African-American mom and who had a male child, I'm echoing everything that Melanie was saying. I think it's extremely important that that there are instances where our children are more inclined to be perceived of as having conduct disorder And another quick example, a 13-year-old that I talked to, a family, they just received an autism diagnosis. And all along, all these years, he's 13 now, it had been perceived of as an emotional disturbance. And his placement and his treatment and everything that he was receiving was with that in mind. That was the wrong diagnosis. And now that he has the right diagnosis, Mom and I are going to talk about, you know, things that can happen for him. But he was 13. And up until that point, everything was going wrong because they never even knew that he had autism. Mm.
Rachel?
One of the most important messages that I try to give to parents and to professionals when I'm either doing one-on-one work or group trainings is the difference between can't and won't for our kids. I think that's, if there's only one lesson that people walk away with after my time with them, I think that's the most important one in terms of our kids and their, quote, behaviors. There is a huge difference between a child who won't do something and a child who can't do something. There is a deliberateness there. That is not to say that a kid with autism cannot have bad behavior. Of course they can. But there is a huge difference in a behavior that's the result of a stressor or something that they're not capable of doing or expressing in a way that we're accustomed to, and a child who's just not going to do it. And I think that that distinction is really important to make for families to be aware and for professionals, teachers, so that they can come at it with the right framing of the behavior, like Melissa was talking about.
Exactly.
Dr. Adarola?
And I will say that on the provider side at Levine, this is why we make sure that our autism evaluations, our diagnostic evaluations, are extremely comprehensive and that we take a lot of time to listen to parents and hear about their concerns and make that a part of our diagnostic process. And also that as a provider group, we continue to talk about these issues, that our professional development includes education on things like implicit bias so that we can continually be aware of what the barriers to accurate diagnosis are and incorporate those practices into our day-to-day evaluations.
I mean, that's where basic cultural competency.
Yes.
These are the conversations we have when we talk about the lack of teachers of color. And this goes across fields. I mean, if we had more people in diagnostic services, we have more doctors
Absolutely.
Of color, we probably see the numbers mm-hmm. change. I mean, I don't know if it would be perfect or ideal or equal.
Right.
But that also doesn't mean that But we're not going to get better with more training and work, what Dr. Adarola is talking about.
Absolutely. Right? And it's extremely important to know that there needs to be education and training and relationship building on all fronts. When I was working for a while as a paraprofessional in the city school district, in classrooms where often teachers would want me to talk with parents about the diagnosis or about sensory issues. A lot of our kids on the autism spectrum have issues with sensory. Well, what is that? Well, luckily, I've been able to talk with providers and learn and understand what it means to need some deep pressure or to need to jump. I remember having an OT years ago telling me when my son was climbing up into the radiator, you know, at school, and we were thinking, okay, that's not good, you know, that he's doing that. Well, I had an OT, though, that explained he's crying out, I need sensory, I need to climb, I need to move. And my body is saying I need to do that. So we structured it. We structured it in his day where he was able to get that sensory input in a healthy and a correct way so that he's not climbing on the. So when I was working as a para, I did that. I did sensory activity with some kindergartners who were on the autism spectrum to help other teachers see that, wow, look how well he's able to sit in that seat for, you know, the next 30 minutes, because we were able to do some of that. So it was education for everyone. It was education for the teachers. It was education for parents. It was education even for some of my OTs to help them understand how to work with some of these students. It was great because we were working collaboratively as a team, and that's what it's all about.
All right, let me get a phone call. This is Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. What I have to say would take almost half a program, which I have asked a number of times that to be able to talk about in more depth, but let me just try to hit it on the top. I wonder if the people there realize or are aware that, and I want to use the word all in a very conscious way because I've been listening to the discussion. So everything that's been mentioned, all of the things being mentioned now, were part of a service system that began in the early 1970s after the Willowbrook Consent Decree, which said no more institutional care. Now, we're talking developmental disability, not mental health. That was a separate kind of problem, kind of solution that didn't work out very well. But this was done in the late 60s and 70s. And there were places across the state, and Rochester was one of them, that had no institutional setting. So what happened there, the good news was, every single service that the people have talked about in the last 15, 20 minutes or more was provided in the public sector with people who did all the outreach, had interdisciplinary teams, in each catchment area. It was a right to service because it's a federally funded program, state funded program. So you don't have to, if you needed extra consultation at the school district, at that time, school district was doing very poor psych evals, you could go to this interdisciplinary team that we had, and they would have kind of a more independent but in-depth analysis. Daycare. There was a daycare center that was integrated, is the word I guess I'd use, integrated, that was a regular, so-called regular daycare center that we worked with to take people with disabilities, children. There were all kinds of individual consultations, schools. We followed every single person we worked with, regardless of African American, regardless of white, whatever you were, because that's the way the program works. So when we would go to the school district, most parents, you know, were learning, and so we would help them learn about that process and be there, because often these big systems have a way of avoiding and do. So now you have a city school district with tons of problems, complaints about special ed, and people throwing up their hands at a candidate's night meeting saying, we don't know what to do. That is a disgrace. And part of this is because what ended this program, if you think I'm not angry, I have every freaking right, because the people you're talking to now could have been getting services, and others that you are talking to, continuously, until the governor of New York decided he didn't want to pay people any more reasonable salaries. So what he was going to do is threaten to get rid of a lot of public workers. But that threat, and I don't know if you know the system well enough to get this, but that threat caused a whole bunch of displacement down through the whole system, because up until close to the end of implementing that, he then pulled back on it. But by then, the programs that were in place started to get insecure and what? So what resulted in the mid to 80s? The whole program, 32 years of excellent, and you can ask any parent that we saw excellent programming, excellent people, was dissolved, and so nobody in the community, families who have people disabled in the community, were able to get these services anymore, because that's the piece they could just take and hunk and throw away. So you know, history is real important in almost everything you talk about, and people ought to be outraged by this, because first of all, you didn't have to take money out of your pocket to get these services. It was part of what we should do for people.
Bonnie, thank you. Rachel, you want to start? Go ahead.
Sure. Thanks for the little bit of history lesson, Bonnie. Right now, in 2018, the government paid for services are received through an agency called OPWDD, the Office for Persons with Developmental Disabilities. There is an eligibility process to that that can be somewhat cumbersome, but it is possible to do. We know at Autism Up that only about 50% of our families have children that are actually eligible for OPWDD, because one of the qualifying criteria is to have an intellectual disability, which is an IQ under 70 or so. Right. And about 50% of the families that are members of Autism Up don't have children who are eligible for those services. So that's really where we see Autism Up, the Golisano Autism Center, and our family navigators coming in to help fill that gap. It is integrally important to us to make sure that the services, the education, the training, the one-on-one support that we have is provided for free. We know that, as Melissa has said numerous times, that the most important advocate for any child with a disability is their parent.
Absolutely.
And it's incredibly important to us to be able to provide programs like the Family Navigator, like the Autism Helpline, like the Facebook group that we have for families, like the workshops and speakers that we provide, all for free. We want to try to relieve some of that barrier and to not close out families whose children are not eligible for OPWDD services. In some ways, those families need this education and this information even more because they don't have the backup of the system, I guess.
Well, and it's also important to know that, you know, there are some people that are on the autism spectrum, some children whose parents may not even understand what OPWDD is, and their children may be eligible, may fit the criteria in terms of their intellectual disability, but the process, the staying power, the waiting 6 months, the waiting a year, the calling back an agency 4 and 5 times, that process in and of itself can be daunting for some people. And in addition, if they're not only doing that for that one child, but this is also a person who's trying to find a job, trying to have stable housing, that may have a personal situation, maybe a domestic violence situation, may have other things that are going on in their lives that are personal stressors. Add that on top of the fact that they now have a child that has these disabilities. It's a lot to juggle. And so what we're hoping is that in my role as a family navigator, that I can help to streamline some of that, to help take away some of that stress, to break down the system and explain it in a way that is simple and in layman's terms that everyone can understand. Sometimes what happens is we have instances where, you know, professionals, whether we're talking about teachers or doctors, or there's that professional language that we speak that sometimes can be daunting for the average parent who doesn't really understand all of this. One of the roles that I'm going to play is to be able to break that down and help it be simpler for them so that they can get access to things that they're eligible to get.
And the helpline, by the way, just launched when, Mary?
It launched July 1st.
Couple of days ago. What is the helpline?
The helpline is an information, advice, and referral line. So if a family member, an individual, or a provider calls and asks about services that exist in our community, such as where can my child go to preschool, where can my child receive after-school services, an evaluation, the operator who has been trained by Autism Up and CP Rochester will give that family member or individual 3 different referral sources in our community and hopefully connect those individuals with a much needed service. Also, Autism Up and CP Rochester will be following up with these individuals and families to ensure that that connection is made.
Let me go ahead and give you the Autism Helpline, which again launched just Sunday. 1-866-AUTISM-4, the number 4. 1-866-AUTISM-4. There you go. We're way late for our only break of the hour. Let's get that. I'm going to come back and get ahead. Had a couple of other questions that are prominent as our community. What you're hearing is what is happening in various sectors of this community, not just following the death of Trevion Rowe, but the urgency that a lot of people felt following that news. We're talking about disparities and how to deal with them and approach them. So you got the new Autism Helpline and a lot of things going on. You just heard Mary Boatfield, who's board president for the Golisano Autism Center. Melissa Parrish is a family navigator for the Golisano Autism Center, works with Autism Up and also telling her own story of a parent of a son with autism. Dr. Susanna Iderola is a pediatric psychologist at Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong, and Rachel Rosner from Autism Up. Let's get that only break and come right back. I'm Evan Dawson. On Wednesday, happy Independence Day. Connections gives way for Capital Steps. The Capital Steps coming your way on Wednesday, a wonderful annual tradition. Hope you're enjoying Independence Day in the week here. Kind of strange in the middle of the week, isn't it? But we're right back on Thursday. We kick off the summer of food, and we will chat with you on Thursday. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The helpline that launched a couple of days ago is there, and then there's a lot of things that are kind of rolling out. The center itself, the new center, is going to open in 2019, is that right?
2019, September.
Okay, but obviously there's a lot of things that are happening in pieces before then.
Absolutely, absolutely. As far as looking at the gaps in services, we talked about daycare. We will have after-school services. We're looking at employment for individuals with autism. We're looking at housing. So again, we're looking at all of the services that currently exist and will be relocated to the Autism Center, but we still have our work to do to ensure that all those gaps are met. And we're working with family members. We're working with community members. There are 60 volunteers that are on committees right now helping to close those gaps.
All right. And there's a number of other points I want to hit before the end of the hour, not the least of which is the question of whether there should be screening for all kids by age two. Dr. Adirola, is that in the offing, and should it be?
Yeah, so the American Academy of Pediatrics mandates screening right at 18 months, and then at some people do it at 24, some people at 30, and some people at 36 that are autism-specific screening as part of more general developmental screening. And this is one way that's been proposed to reduce some disparities in our communities, because if you mandate screening for everybody, then at least everybody gets eyes on with the question, with the frame of, is there a potential developmental delay? And then if so, could it be an autism spectrum disorder? And this has been a big initiative within our community. The excellent work of pediatricians to do screenings, especially within the city, has been attributed to some of the increases in prevalence have been attributed to better screening across the country. There's also an initiative through the Children's Institute in Rochester called GROW, which is doing mandated screening across multiple dimensions: language, vision, dental, developmental, speech, hearing, for all three-year-olds in Rochester City. So those kinds of major initiatives are really dedicated to reducing these disparities, because they're trying to touch all families.
Okay. I think that's excellent. My son was diagnosed at three, and I am an example of I remember saying, something's not right, you know, language-wise. He wasn't speaking. He wasn't gesturing. But I also remember hearing from the daycare provider and from his pediatrician, you know, boys talk later. He's such a sweet kid. I'm sure he'll, you know, come around. I'm sure it'll be fine. And so those kinds of reactions are very often what can happen at 18 months or one, that mom's being poo-pooed away, that I'm sure it's fine, or I'm sure he'll outgrow it. And I think that having a screening for everyone, where you're asking certain poignant questions that the parent can look for, you know, am I noticing whether my child's gesturing? Am I noticing whether they're lining their toys up in this kind of sequential order? As I look back in hindsight, there are a lot of things that when someone finally listened to me and asked me certain questions, that I could say, yes, 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 yes. But it took a while. It took up until about the age of three before someone would actually ask the questions. And I remember his getting eligible for early intervention, but that was for speech and for OT. But it was a separate diagnosis for the neurological evaluation when we actually found out about autism. So we had to wait another, you know, 6 months. And this was downstate, but this was with me pushing. This was with me saying, something still is not right. I would like to find out if there's something else going on. So having a process where all kids are being asked, all parents are being asked by their pediatrician these questions, I think would be excellent.
You want to add to that, Rachel?
Yeah. Just like Melissa said, hindsight is 20/20, honey.
Right.
You know, I am an early childhood educator as far as my education is concerned and my early work experience. So I was working in that field when I was having kids, and I just couldn't put my finger on it. I knew that my son wasn't developing like the other kids his age. But there wasn't any, it wasn't really a hugely loud alarm bell. I just couldn't put my finger on it. And, you know, I had friends that worked in the field that would come and take a look and answer my questions. And everybody said, don't worry about it, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. You know, there's a broad range of normal and all that other kind of stuff. But once someone actually said the word to me and asked me some questions, does he do this, does he not do that? it was like a bolt of lightning.
Yes.
Ah, this is the thing. This is the string that ties everything together. And we want to make sure that every family has the ability to access that information. We want to try to kick down as many barriers as possible. That's why we have so many different ways for families to come in and get that support and the information. They can call the helpline. They can make an appointment with the family navigator. They can access us through email. We don't want cost to be a barrier. We don't want location to be a barrier. And we want to make sure that every parent, every family is getting the information that they need so that they can do right by their kids.
Rachel, do you agree with Bonnie that the public sector used to be more robust in dealing with this and has been gutted a bit, and that's made it harder, needed the gaps to be filled in different ways?
Yes and no. I think that the general direction that government-funded services are going is a good one. And that is to get people with disabilities to be able to live happy, productive lives in the community, not over there,
right,
in a building over there, in a school over there, in a program over there. The funds are being shifted to allow people to live in the community, to do what they want to do in the way that they want to do that. As the parent of two kids with autism, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that and how important it is to be able to access that funding in that way that allows my kids to make their own decisions about what makes them happy and how they want to live. So I think it's a, it's, there are always bumps in the road and will continue to be. I think that's safe to be said for any person with any kind of disability, which is 20% of the general population, by the way, has a disability. But I think that generally the trend to keeping people with disabilities in the community where they want to live and how they want to live is the right thing.
I agree.
During our brief break, Mary, you brought up not just the question on diagnosis, early diagnosis, but something called secondary diagnosis. What is
it? Right. Many children, teens, and adults with autism may have a secondary diagnosis, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. I think at least 50%, if you read, children with
Absolutely.
Autism do have that.
Yes.
And again, that has to be addressed along with the autism. We see mental health challenges and disorders as early as 4 and 5 years old. And that would be under, the mental health, Office of Mental Health. So, again, the state agencies have to work together, but the schools and the providers have to work together to ensure that we're addressing all of the needs of the individuals, the autism and the other disabilities or disorders or challenges that they may have, so we can, again, work with the whole person.
And I want to echo that, working with the whole person. I think one of the things that I've learned from providers, from my son, from other parents, is just how important it is to destigmatize autism and to destigmatize difference. That to learn differently, to process information in different ways, to go through the world and experience the world in a different way isn't a bad thing. And that it really benefits the rest of us. As a teacher myself, my son has helped me understand that people learn differently. And that as a teacher, I need to think about how I present material and understand that it may be processed differently for that person. And so I think it's extremely important that one of the things that's changed is that we as a society are recognizing that people who may experience the world differently shouldn't be pushed off somewhere, for them to be on the side, but that we should adjust and manage and design our programs to incorporate everyone.
Down to about our last 90 seconds, and I've asked this question on a number of occasions with people from the autism and the treatment community, and you get sort of varying answers. And Dr. Iderola, I've heard from listeners who say, well, isn't everyone sort of on the spectrum? Jerry Seinfeld joked about that. Is that true? And I know that at times can be a very sensitive sort of comment. Now I see the latest numbers from estimations from the CDC, about 1 in 59 children diagnosed. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that it was 1 in 88 or 1 in 100, 1 in 125. Do we have any reason to think that we're settling near where the number is? I'm going to use a term that's the wrong term, but naturally or inherently, are we close? Do we have any reason to think that that's going to be 1 in 50 or 1 in 40? What do we know about that?
The prevalence rates are extremely hard to predict, sure. And a lot of the themes that have already been brought up about increased awareness, better diagnosis of children of color and awareness within communities of color have been kind of associated with the increasing prevalence. And to your point about all of us being on the spectrum, I think that concept of kind of neurodiversity represents a little bit of this whole person right. approach that Melissa's talking about, where we're not seeing each other as labels, but really for our unique profile, our unique pattern of our strengths. And that also sometimes comes with area of need, and we all have areas of need, and we all rely on the people who support us through those things. So also within the self-advocate community, this idea of neurodiversity, I think, has really taken off, and that just appreciates all of our differences, and that we can find strength in people who tend to be rigid in their thinking, and think about what that means for them and how that can contribute to society, and not always focus on difference, but really just dimensions of who we are.
The new helpline is 2 days old. It's 1-866-AUTISM-4, the number 4, 866-AUTISM-4, GalisanoAutismCenter.org for more information there. Dr. Susanna Iderola is a pediatric psychologist at Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong. Nice having you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Rachel Rosner from Autism Up, always nice to see you. Thank you for being
here. You too. Thanks.
Our thanks to Melissa Parrish, who is a family navigator for the Golisano Autism Center, also with Autism Up, and telling your story beautifully. Continued good health and good fortune to your family.
You.
Thank you so much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mary Boatfield, board president for the Golisano Autism Center, thanks to you as well. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Happy Independence Day. Talk to you Thursday.